Come for computer graphics, and we are right now speaking about ray tracing. So I introduced ray tracing on Tuesday. Ray tracing is just an alternative technique for generating images, so it's an alternative for rasterization. And it has fundamental differences. So the idea of ray tracing is that instead of iterating over all the objects and projecting these objects and rendering these objects onto the screen, we go the other way around. We iterate over all pixels, and for each of these pixels, we find out which object is visible. And in order to do that, we need to be able to cast a ray into the scene. That means for every pixel in our scene, so if this is our image plane, this is our eye, and I told you that in this example we can really imagine that the image plane lives in 3D. It's a grid of pixels in 3D just in front of my eye. And now to find out what is visible in that pixel, I have to cast a ray through that pixel into the scene, and find out which object this ray intersects. Yeah? Okay, so here's one that gets a hit point. And this is just another way to generate images, if we only apply that for eye rays in general, we will be slower than with rasterization. But the advantage now is that once we have this interface casting rays, we can also use that, for instance, to compute reflections, refractions, and stuff like that, and also can easily generate shadows using this ray interface. Yeah? So this is something that is not that simple to achieve using rasterization. So that's a big advantage of ray tracing. Nevertheless, ray tracing is typically much slower than rasterization. And in particular, it's very, very slow if this ray casting operation here is implemented or not implemented very well, or if no optimizations are made for that part. And this is what we want to speak about now in this chapter. How can we do this efficiently? How can we perform this ray casting operator efficiently on very complex scenes with millions of triangles and stuff like that? And in fact, there are two things that we have to consider. The first one, we need tests to find out whether a given ray intersects an object, one single object, one single primitive. In our case, these are typically triangles, but for ray tracing, one of the advantages is that it's very easy or very simple also to include other primitives, like spheres, for instance. Yeah? We will see the intersection test of a ray with a sphere, that this is a very simple test. And now the good thing is we can include a sphere in ray tracing very easily and very efficiently. In rasterization, we have to typically subdivide that sphere into triangles because we know how to rasterize triangles. We could also write a rasterizer for spheres, but that would already be more complicated. In particular, now if we do not only use spheres, but also ellipses or ellipsoids or whatever, that's still quite easily doable with ray tracing, but writing a rasterization for these is already complicated. Okay, nevertheless, so we need a method to intersect rays with our primitives in our scene. That's number one. And number two, we need a way to quickly find out for a large set of primitives, millions of primitives, to identify those objects that can get an intersection, or to put it the other way around, to quickly reject or discard those parts of the scene that definitely won't hit that ray, and to restrict this primitive intersection computation really only to a few ones along the ray, and to quickly throw away all the others, and not to make for a particular ray to intersect this ray with each of the 1 million triangles in our scene, that would just be far too expensive. So that's the second part. Yeah, to accelerate this, we typically use acceleration structures. This we will speak about in the second part, probably on Tuesday. And today, we will focus on the basic primitive tests. Yeah? So intersecting one given ray with a sphere, a triangle, and a polygon, and a box, and yeah, the most simple primitives. Okay, good. Yeah. Just to remind you once again, I told you in doing ray tracing with really nice global illumination effects and stuff like that means that per pixel we only shoot one eye ray, but maybe 1,000 additional secondary rays. Yeah. So for every pixel, if we say we shoot 1,000 rays and our image has 1 million rays, that means we have to shoot 1 billion rays. Yeah? That's a lot. And it's all the time in our computation, more than 90% just go into this intersection test. So it's important to have that one fast. Okay, good. So how do these computations look like? I mean, that's not rocket science. It's rather simple. A ray, typically we will describe in the following form. It's an eye point. An array has an eye point. It has a direction. And T is the ray parameter, yeah, that enumerates points along the ray. And for now, we will assume that the direction has length 1. We will see that later on in some formulas that this will help us to save some arithmetics. Or alternatively, we also saw that if we really span our array by computing a point here on the image plane, yeah, then we can also parameterize it using the difference between that point on the image plane and the eye. Okay, but that's for now we will assume that we have this form here. Okay, and now many of our primitives will live on a plane, will be planar, like a triangle, a rectangle, a parallelogram, arbitrary quadrilateral, or a polygon. They are always planar. So the first thing that we want to be able to is to compute the intersection of a ray with a plane. And we will have that in multiple places. And I hope you remember that we can define a plane in the following way, the typical way to define such a plane is to take the normal of the plane, that's a vector perpendicular to the plane, and d is a scalar, it's the distance of the plane to the origin. And if we have this, we can describe a plane by this. Yeah, it's all points x for which this expression here is true. Yeah, the scalar product of n and x equals d. We will see that also again once in a minute. Yeah, that's the normal way to describe such a plane. Okay, now if we have our ray that starts here and it has a direction d, and now if we want to find the intersection with a plane, yeah, that's point Q, we can simply plug in this ray equation, P of T is this one here. We can plug this in into our plane equation and solve for T. So P of T is E plus TD. And we can solve for T, and then we get this expression. And if we put this T into our P of T again, we get this intersection point. Yeah? This is the intersection point. Q is E plus, that's the T that we computed here, times the direction of the ray. Yeah? So that's not very complicated. And we only have to compute a few scalar products mainly. And one interesting observation, if this one here becomes zero, obviously we have a problem. When does this happen? It happens if the ray direction is perpendicular to the normal direction. What does that mean? It just means that the ray is parallel to the plane. Yeah? And of course, then we have a problem. Then either we have no solution, yeah, because the ray is just parallel, or the ray can also be on the plane, and then the entire ray intersects the plane. Yeah, so that's a degenerate case. And otherwise, we get here the intersection. Okay, so that's simple. It is an example where we intersect such a ray with a surface for which we have an implicit description. Implicit description in that case means, yeah, we describe a plane by using such an equation. Yeah, every point that fulfills this equation is on the plane. That's an implicit description of the plane. Yeah, it's something like this here. It's a function on the points, and we know everywhere where this function is zero, we have a point of our surface. And if we have such an implicit surface equation, it's quite simple to compute the intersection by just putting the ray or applying this implicit function to the ray. Setting that to zero, and here we still have an unknown t, and then we only have to solve for t and get the solution. Yeah, that's exactly what we did here. We just here applied our implicit equation here to p of t, and then we solved for t. Okay, and this we can also apply for a bit more complicated or more interesting objects, like, for instance, a sphere. Yeah? A sphere is most simple to be described using an implicit equation. So if we assume that the sphere has a center at C and has a radius R, then we can describe all points on the sphere using this equation here. That's just the vector of the point to the center, and all what we need to find out is that the length of this vector is R. Yeah? Every point on the surface on the sphere has distance r to the center. Yeah, and the length of this vector we can compute by computing the scalar product of the vector with itself, and this gives us the squared length. And to keep things simple, we just say the squared length should be r squared. Yeah, we could also take the square root, but that makes computation unnecessarily complicated. And yeah, to have it in the form f of x equals 0, we bring the r squared to the left. So that's our implicit equation for points on the sphere. Okay, now we can apply this for our ray. Yeah, we take the ray e plus td, and we replace x by e plus td. This gives us this equation. And now we can multiply here, or this scalar product we can apply to the single summons, and in the end we will end up with this equation here. That looks a bit complicated, but in fact it's not. But the important thing that we see is that it's a quadratic equation. It's quadratic in T, and okay, so here we have t squared times, yeah, the scalar product of d with itself. And here we know this is 1. Yeah? It's the length of the direction of the ray, and we said this will be 1. This should be 1. So this becomes simple. So here this is a scalar product of the direction with a vector from the I to the center of the sphere. So that's quite simple to compute. Yeah, and this is just the distance, the squared distance between the I and the center of the sphere. Yeah, n minus r squared. Yeah? And now you see it's a quadratic equation. The quadratic term is 1. The linear term here is this. And the constant term is this. And I hope you know how to solve such quadratic equations. We can use this formula, yeah, A is 1, so we can use this formula here to compute T, and B is the linear term, and C is that term here, yeah, So all these terms are quite simple to compute. Yeah, and this gives us the solutions for t. And it's quadratic. That means, in general, we have 0, 1, or 2 solutions. Yeah, I hope you also remember that. And how many we have depends on, here, the term under the square root. So if this term is negative, then we will have no solution. If it's 0, or if it's positive, then we have 2 solutions, because now we have this plus and minus. And if it's 0, then the 2 solutions collapse, though in fact we only have 1 solution. Okay, and now if you think about this a little bit, it's very clear what these different cases mean. So if the discriminant here is negative, that means we have no intersection, and in fact that means that the ray passes the sphere. Yeah? It doesn't intersect. There's no solution. If we have 2 solutions, then that's the normal case that we intersect the sphere, and then in that case we have 2 intersections, an entry point and an exit point. And if it's 0, then the ray just touches the sphere. Yeah? The ray then is tangent to the sphere. Oh, so that's again a special case. But the typical case, no solution, or yes, we do have a solution, or we do have an intersection, and in that case, we get the 2 intersection points. And in fact, if we go back to that formula, the nice thing is that since we are only interested in the closer intersection, yeah, we typically want to find the first intersection, we just have to take the smaller of the 2 solutions, and since this square root is always positive, we know that the smaller one is the one for the minus. Yeah? The one for the minus is the entry point, and the other one is the exit point. Okay, unless we have the maybe strange situation that our ray starts in the sphere, that makes things a bit more complicated. But okay, that's not a difficult point. Okay, so that's very simple. Yeah, intersecting a sphere with a ray is quite simple. For efficiency, of course, one would proceed as follows. So compute B, that's this color product, then compute C, then compute the discriminant, and then if the discriminant is negative, we know there's no solution, and otherwise, only otherwise, we have to compute the square root. So the square root takes some time, but okay, that's the most complicated thing. Okay, so intersecting a ray with a sphere is very fast, and in fact, we will also see later on that we typically do not only use spheres as primitives, but maybe also as hulls for more complicated objects, so that we can quickly decide if we compute a bounding sphere for an object, we can very quickly, using this discriminant, decide if the ray does not hit that bounding sphere, it won't hit any part inside the object, for instance. Yeah? So a sphere is a very good bounding object for ray acceleration. Okay, good. Another object or primitive that we use less as a real primitive but more as a bounding geometry are boxes. Yeah, and yeah. Again, for boxes, the finding the intersection of a ray with a box boils down to finding the intersection between a ray and a plane. Yeah, so we will look at that a little bit in more detail. So let's assume we have 3 points, A, B, and C, yeah, and they span a plane. They all lie on the plane, and they define the plane. And we want to find the intersection now with a ray. So the first thing is that we compute the normal to that plane, and that's just normal from 3 points. Typically, is computed using a cross product. That means we take the vector from A to B, for instance, and from A to C and take the cross product, and this gives us a normal. And this gives us then this form here for the plane equation. That's essentially the form that we had before. It's a little bit different. It just says a point is on the plane if the vector from the point to A is perpendicular to n. And just multiplying this one out brings us to this form that we saw before. Yeah, it's exactly the same here. D is then the distance to the coordinate system. Okay, so that's our plane here. But now we can carry that a little bit further, and we can say, okay, now this is our term. If this is zero, we are on the plane. But we can also quickly see that if this term is larger than zero, then we are on top of the plane, for instance. And if it's smaller than zero, we are beneath the plane. And what is on top and what is beneath is defined by the direction of the normal. Yeah? So if our normal is pointing upwards, then all points above the plane, for all points, nx minus d is positive, or nx is larger than d, and for all below, it's smaller than d, or it's negative. So we can take this here as a kind of indicator that tells us whether we are above, on the plane, or below the plane. Okay, that's simple, but that's a notion or something that is used quite often. And it defines us half space. So it defines us half spaces. For every plane, we have a positive half space and a negative half space. Yeah? This we can now use, for instance, to compute whether a point x here, lies, for instance, within a triangle or within any polyhedron. And a polyhedron is essentially what up to now we called a polygon, but it's as a polygon we just describe the edges, and a polyhedron is the inside of a polygon. And in fact, it's not an arbitrary polygon, but a convex polygon. And if we have such a convex polygon, and the triangle is the probably most simple convex polyhedron, then we can simply say this triangle is just the intersection of the half spaces defined by the edges. So this edge here defines a positive and a negative half space. And this one here defines a positive and a negative half space, and this one a positive and a negative half space. And you see the triangle is just the intersection of all the negative half spaces. Yeah, that's very simple. And of course, this only works for convex polygons. So if you have something like this here, it won't work. Yeah, and you remember that was, doesn't matter. Because here, for instance, the intersection of all the negative half spaces would be, so this region here, that's fine, this region, but now we get this region from this edge, and with this edge, we cut out this region, so this one is thrown away, and that's it. So as a result, we would get this one. Yeah, that's not what we want. Yeah, so for not convex polygons, this doesn't work. But in the case that it's convex, we can say, it's just the intersection of half spaces. And now to find out whether a point is in that triangle, in that case, just means evaluate these three scalar products here. Yeah. And look at the signs, and as soon as you found one that is positive, then you can immediately stop and say outside, and if all are negative, then you know you're inside. Yeah, so that's a simple point in triangle test in 2D. Okay, good, but we can use these half spaces further. So another idea is to use these half spaces to define so-called slabs. So what is a slab? A slab is take two planes that have the same normal, yeah, but have different d values, so different distances to the origin. So that plane has distance d near, and that plane has distance d far. And between the two planes, yeah, this defines a region which we call slab. Yeah, it's just kind of interval in a certain direction. Okay, and from these slabs, now we can again generate geometry, and the most obvious one would be a box. Yeah, a box is just the intersection of two perpendicular slabs, and in 3D, yeah, so in 2D it's the intersection of two slabs that are perpendicular, and in 3D it's the intersection of three perpendicular slabs. Yeah, so here the example for 2D, and in 3D we just take these, typically take these directions, and or if we take these three directions, then we speak about a so-called axis-aligned bounding box. So that's a box defined from slabs that are parallel to the three main axes. Okay, so that's not complicated, or that's simple. And now let's have a look at the problem that we have such an axis-aligned bounding box or an arbitrary slab. It doesn't need to be axis-aligned. And we want to intersect that with a ray. Yeah? Okay. So first of all, we have to consider the fact that our object is the intersection of all these slabs. So if we know how to intersect our ray with one slab, yeah, we can intersect the ray with all the slabs that we have, and we can quickly see that our ray intersects the intersection only if the intersection intervals also overlap. Okay, what does that mean? Let's look at this ray. Yeah? It intersects this slab, the vertical one, between T1 and T2, and it intersects this slab between T3 and T4. But there's no interval on the ray, or no point on the ray, where it's both in this slab and in this slab. So this interval and this interval, they don't overlap. Yeah? So we have no intersection. Here, for this ray, it intersects this slab between T1 and T2, and this slab between T3 and T4. Now these two intervals overlap, yeah? And we know we have an intersection. The order is a bit weird, yeah? So here again the example. So we go, this is the interval on the ray for which we have an intersection with this slab, and this is the interval for which we have an intersection with this slab. And yeah, the overlap region here, this is the region where we are in both slabs, and this is just the result, what we are looking for. Yeah, this is the interval where we are inside this box here. Okay, and how can we compute these intersections? We already know how to compute the intersection with a plane. And now the nice thing is that now we have to compute the intersections with two planes, but they are parallel. So lots of the computations are the same. And you see, yeah, this scalar product is the same. This scalar product is the same. So the only difference lies in the different d values. Yeah, so once this and this has been computed, Tn and Tf can be very quickly be computed. So So we can reuse lots of results. Okay, so that can be done quickly. Again, it's worth to look at the case that this one becomes zero, and this is just if the ray is parallel to a slab. Yeah? And that's, again, something where we need a special consideration. Okay, so this is how we can compute these intersections. And now, one further remark. You remember, for an axis-aligned bounding box, these ends are the main axis. And if you look at this formula here, you see that the scalar products we need are the scalar products with a main axis. Yeah? And these scalar products become particularly simple because it's something like whatever, x, y, z, scalar product with 1, 0, 0. And that simply means just take the first component of the first vector. Yeah? And in that case, take the second component and so forth. So these scalar products here are just the zero, the first, second, or the third component of E. So yeah, these formulae are really very simple if we have the main axis. So that's very fast. Yeah. So an axis-aligned bounding box is obviously something for which we can quickly compute the intersections, and that's why it's quite often used. This is how the structure looks like for an axis-aligned bounding box. It's defined by two vertices. So in 2D, such a box looks like this, and we can define that by the minimum x value, the maximum x value, the minimum y, and the maximum y. These define our slabs. And yeah, if we summarize all the mins and all the max, we get these two points, yeah, p min and p max. So these are the minimum values and these are the maximum values. And this is this point, this is p min, and this is p max. So it p min and p max kind of span this axis-aligned bounding box. Okay, so this is used quite often, yeah. And if we now want to intersect such an axis-aligned bounding box with a ray, we can use code like this. Maybe it looks more complicated, but there are quite a few comments in it. So what happens here? The parameters, as parameters, we have an axis. So here we have a ray. We have an axis-aligned bounding box. Here we want to return the ray parameter for which we have the first intersection and the first intersection point. And now we iterate over the three slabs. Yeah. So I is the essentially x, y, and z. Here we determine whether our ray is parallel to one of these slabs. If so, we have to do something special. Yeah. So if we have a ray that goes into this direction, so that has a zero component, a zero in the x component, yeah, then this ray goes into this direction, and obviously it doesn't make sense to compute the intersections with these planes. Yeah? So what we have to do here now is to check whether our ray is outside this interval. Yeah, if it's here, that is exactly the case if x is larger than x max. Or on the other side here, x is smaller than x min. If one of these is the case, yeah, then we are not in the slab. Then the entire ray is outside the slab, and we can immediately quit. That's here. And otherwise, if it's inside that slab, then the entire ray is inside. Yeah? Then we can just continue. And otherwise, we have a real intersection. And now here is computing. That's exactly this formula that we had before. And yeah, here, so this little trick, division typically is more expensive than multiplication. So if you several times want to divide by the same term, by di, you can do this division once and then always multiply the reciprocal. Okay, yeah. And so this gives us entry and exit point. Now we have to be a little bit careful. It can be that T2 is smaller than T1 if the rate just goes into the opposite direction. Into this direction, then we will first hit x max and then x min. Yeah, so this is T2, this is T1. Yeah, then we have to reverse because then the entry is T2 and not T1. That happens here, and then we intersect with a current minimum and maximum. Now that's this intersection computation on the ray interval. So if your current interval that intersects the scene or the current set of slabs is this one, and now we get a new entry here and a new exit here, the new interval should go from here to here. Yeah, that's just this intersection computation. This happens here. And this test here now checks whether our interval isn't zero. It can become zero. Oh, this is a bit too full. That's exactly this case. This ray. So the first slab we examined was this one. Yeah, so we get this interval. So that's our interval after intersecting with slab X. Now we intersect with Y, and then we get this entry. And now we say, okay, the new entry is the later of the current entries. So it's this one and this one. The new entry remains this one. And the new exit is the minimum of the two exits. So it's the minimum of this one and this one. So we get this as T max. Yeah, and now you see T max is smaller than T min. So obviously our interval is empty. So the check whether the interval is empty is here. And yeah, if it never left the loop by such a return in the end, we know here, we know that we have an intersection. And we can simply compute that using T min and return a 1, or true to say, yes, we have an intersection. OK, good. So that's a very not too complicated operation. And in fact, it's a special case for so-called slab volumes. And a slab volume is just the intersection of several slabs. The axis-aligned bounding box is a special case. But for other purposes, it perfectly makes sense to, for instance, take more slabs like this and this, and then also slabs that maybe go into this direction and diagonal, so you can further reduce or generate more adaptive volumes. And if you look at that, the only point where what is needed to extend it to an arbitrary number of slabs is to increase this index, and instead of to use P of I, that's the ith component of P, and that's just P times P scalar product with Ni. So if you have arbitrary scalar products, this P of I has to be replaced by P scalar product with Ni. Yeah? But it's quite simple to extend it that way. Okay, good. And my plan was to also describe the ray triangle intersection today, but we won't be able to. The time is already up. So we will do that the next week on Tuesday and then look into acceleration structures. How to make ray tracing faster. Thanks a lot. See you on Tuesday.